the revenue committee. We're going to start at the second part of the agenda. We'll try and get through our work sessions here before we get into the longer hearing on House Bill 3057. Let's begin with a work session on House Bill 2159. Let's see. Dick, is that you?
That's me.
Please tell us where we are.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Dick Yates with Legislative Revenue. We heard this bill in February, I guess. Notes are old. At this point, Ways and Means has still not finished the budgets for forestry or the Oregon State University. And what the bill does is to establish forest products harvest tax rates to fund a portion of the cost of administering the Forest Practices Act, forest research at Oregon State University, and activities by the Department of Forestry with respect to providing services to non-industrial private forest land owners. So there are three tax rates in the bill. They are in the bill right now blank. And we need essentially to have the Ways and Means activity on the budgets to determine what the rates need to be. Otherwise, I think the bill is ready to go.
So the recommendation or the request is to move it with the blanks
to
Ways and Means and let them fill the blanks in to match the budget?
Right. Okay. Now, Representative Beck had asked some questions last time,
Uh-oh.
And Celia is here to respond to those questions relating to how much the tax rate would have to be increased to pick up the general fund portion of the funding for the non-industrial private forest land services.
Did you want to bring Mr. Seeley up to...
No, I don't.
Well, you know, as long as...
It's obviously a foggy moment.
Is that what this relates to, or is this something else?
Yes.
Okay. Why don't we ask Mr. Seeley to come up? Well, rather than ask Representative Beck to restate his question, I guess if you could respond to the question as related by Mr. Yates.
Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, Clark Seeley, Assistant State Forester for the Department of Forestry. Thank you for the opportunity to come up and share some information with you today. At our hearing in February with you, as we discussed the bill and the programs that it supports and so forth, my recollection and notes are that Representative Beck asked us what would be the impact to the harvest tax rate if all of the remaining general fund in the forestry assistance program was converted to harvest tax. And basically the handout that you have this afternoon shows that the governor's recommended budget information is shown at the top of the page, and you can see that the forestry assistance program is supported by four different types of funds, one of which, of course, is harvest tax, and then you also see the general fund amount there, $711,000. And so the question, the current rate is 15 cents per thousand to support that harvest tax amount of a little over $1 million. And so the question was, what would be the rate impact if that other 711 of general fund were also converted to harvest tax? And that's shown down at the bottom of the page then. You see the GRB tax rate at 15 cents current rate, and then the additional general fund would be 17 cents per thousand. So the total would be 32 cents per thousand board feet for next biennium.
Would you like to ask?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Okay.
Assume we're not going to do anything about that. But
Christina McNitt, you testified in favor of this bill back at the February hearing. Are you comfortable in moving this in blank to Ways and Means? Okay. Ray Wilkson, I don't know if you're okay. Thumbs up from Small Woodlands and OFIC. Okay, thank you very much. Then we are in work session. I'd entertain a motion. Would it be a motion to the floor? And to refer to Ways and Means, is that it? That's what we're doing? Okay.
Chair.
Representative Beck.
I would move House Bill 2159 to the floor, correct?
Yep.
With a subsequent referral.
You want a due pass?
With a due pass recommendation, okay. Subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and with blanks.
Yeah.
Open.
The motion would be to move House Bill 2159, to the floor with a due pass recommendation with referral to Ways and Means, with the blanks that are in the bill, and on the understanding then that Ways and Means will address these blanks with their budget process as part of the budget for the agency. Is there any question, any discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Bay.
Aye.
Representative Beck.
Aye.
Representative Brown.
Excused.
Representative Pat.
Aye.
Representative Williams.
Aye.
Representative
West.
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Tabori.
Used.
And Chair
Shetterly. Aye. House Bill 2159 goes to the floor with a tour through the Ways and Means Committee. The motion is carried. Let's jump to Senate Bill 301, open a work session on that. Oh, wait, Dick, you're here. Let me close that work session. Let's go to 3537 and open a work session on that. Stay within the subject matter area. Please.
Mr. Chair, we heard this bill earlier. I have a request from Representative Williams to go back through the bill line by line again.
Glad you haven't lost your sense of humor.
But could you start from the back of the bill?
What we have here is the conclusion, essentially, or partial conclusion of the work that was assigned to the Department of Revenue during the interim, so that we have in the bill a process established, rather than putting into statute like we currently have a set of values, a process has been established whereby the Department of Revenue annually estimates or determines the specially assessed values of forest land in the Oregon Forest Land Program. And also it requires them to develop models for this purpose and does provide some general fund funding, one of the reasons it has a subsequent to Ways and Means, to contract for some outside assistance in the development of those models. And it also establishes an appeal procedure, which is a class action process with respect to those real market values for forest land. And as I noted before, most of the rest of the bill is simply making those provisions work. You do have a revenue impact and a staff measure summary, fiscal impact, and I believe the bill is, you have a dash one set of amendments you need to consider.
Do you see the dash ones?
Dash ones, we had those at the meeting. We had those on Monday. Or was it Monday? Friday.
When we heard
them last. And Dick, I think he took us through these line by line, too.
They're underneath.
I have some extra.
Oh, okay. It was more.
Got them.
Okay. Mr. Chair. Representative Beck.
I think I asked some questions last time. I don't know if I got answers, but maybe Dick can refresh my. It's more of a question, is just understanding the tax system a little better. My sense is that timberland, I guess the question is, if there is a downturn in the timber market, sudden downturn, will the property, will the land values be adjusted rapidly or commensurately with the downturn in the market, or will this process that we're adopting enable land values to change dramatically related to market conditions in the timber industry? Does this bill affect that at all?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that if you compare the two processes, this is probably more responsive than current law. Current law starts with statutory values and indexes them over a 7-year moving average. So it does tend to smooth out any sort of fluctuations in market as they affect
the current law.
What this bill does is require the Department of Revenue to annually determine values. And so that should be more responsive to changes in the market characteristics. I would think there'll be somewhat of a lag because you're always looking at historical data to try to determine what current values are.
And they're setting land values?
Yes.
So I guess my concern is if they set land values in response to a momentary drop in the market, and those then are become the new real market values, that's the term? They become the new base.
They become, yes. They would be the
base.
The market value in forest land use.
Right. And then that value can only increase 3% a year, or that the tax on that value can only increase at 3% a year, correct?
Let me just back up
yeah.
for a second. Basically, what you have currently and under this program is two different values, and the lesser of the two is what goes on the tax roll as the assessed value. So you have a specially assessed value in forest use, which is now well above the Measure 50 maximum assessed value. So for short-run fluctuations in value, it's likely that the maximum assessed values will continue to control, and so you would get a 3% increase per year based on those maximum assessed values. Now, if that went on for some period of time, which wouldn't be too long, the specially assessed values would be less than the maximum assessed values, and so they would be the lesser of the two, and they would control. So if you did get a big reduction in forest land value, then the specially assessed values would move below the maximum assessed values, and they would control what the land would be assessed at.
Okay. Well, I'm just concerned about situations where the value would be dropped to respond to an immediate short-term change, and then the market would recover quickly, but the base rate would have adjusted downward and not maybe be able to get caught up to where it should be. That's
I don't disagree with your analysis of that, except that I think that's really a consequence, isn't it, of Measure 50 and treating this property as the same as other real property under Measure 50. That's a
right.
risk, I guess. That's an aspect of the application of Measure 50 in any property potentially.
Well, except that some industries, and timber is certainly one of them, is more susceptible to world market fluctuations than maybe some other types of commercial properties.
So let me ask Dick, the fluctuation will take place in two ways. One will be on the real property and one will be on the price of timber. Now, obviously,
right.
for the real property is going to reflect the price of timber, but the biggest swings are going to occur in the timber prices, aren't they? I would
yeah.
expect that the property doesn't fluctuate
that's
as much as the
kind
timber
of what
does.
I'm asking.
I would think that is true. To a certain extent, it depends on the nature of the appraisal process or the valuation process. If it's based on an income approach, then you're not really looking at short-term fluctuations so much as you are for long-term expectations
mm-hmm.
and discounting those back
mm.
to a present value. If you were looking at the sales of bare land, essentially, during the year preceding this valuation period, and using that as a basis of determining market value, then you might very well have fast reactions and sensitivity to what's going on. If bare land values reflected what's going
right.
on in the timber market.
Yeah, I'm overstating my concern, I'm sure. I just I'm just theorizing a little bit here. But
no, it's worth knowing what the effect is.
You want a motion?
I'm ready for a motion. Go ahead.
Okay.
We need the -1 amendments first.
Yeah. I'll move the -1 amendments to House Bill 3537.
Representative Beck moves the -1 amendments to House Bill 3537. Is there any further discussion, any discussion on that motion? Any objection? So ordered. The next motion to be to the floor with a due pass and with referral to Ways and Means.
So moved.
Representative Beck moves House Bill 3537 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that it be referred to the Joint Ways and Means Committee. Is there any discussion on that motion? Okay, please call the roll.
Representative Bates?
Aye.
Representative Beck?
Aye.
Representative Brown?
He's excused.
Aye.
Representative Williams?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Savory?
Aye.
Chair Sederi?
Aye. House Bill 3537 goes to the floor through the Ways and Means Committee as amended. Chair requests unanimous consent that we return to work session on House Bill 2159 for the purpose of allowing Representative Carlson. Did you vote on that? Representative Gaffori to vote. Is there any objection? We are back in work session on House Bill 2159. Representative Gaffori, how do you vote?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. That takes us then. We will switch now to Senate Bill 301. Open work session on that. And looks like it must be Paul.
This is a cease and desist.
Yeah. And then while Paul's bringing us up to date, let me invite Ms. Constantopoulos and her lawyer.
Mr. Chair, if you recall last week during the work session on Senate Bill 301A, there was a concern about the language on page 3, lines 20 through 24 on page 3, if you've got the bill there, about the cease and desist order and the civil penalties and separating those two so that they did not apply, civil penalties did not apply to the language is about to engage in. In other words, a prospective act. And so council has drafted an amendment at the request of the committee, and that's the A4 amendment, which is designed to correct that.
So we have that, we're deleting the language and to assess civil penalties on line 22, so that takes penalties out of a cease and desist order for a threatened violation. And then we're adding a new subsection 7 that allows civil penalties within a cease and desist order, but only for action that a person has been engaged in or is engaging in. And I guess if you want to clarify that for us and tell us that's what you think fits the bill.
Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, for the record, this is Pamela Constantopoulos. I'm the director of the State Board of Tax Service Examiners. We are in support of this amendment, and we do feel that it clarifies the issue that was brought before you in the last session.
Any questions? Okay. The chair would move the dash 4 amendments then to Senate Bill 301. Is there any second on the motion? Any objection? Okay. Mr. Chair, we're probably done with you. Thanks.
Do you want a motion?
Please. Yeah, we've got the bill as amended in front of us, and this one, I think, goes straight to the floor.
Move Senate Bill 301 as amended to the House floor to be passed.
Okay. Let me just make sure where the A4 is the only amendment that we needed to put into this? I think so. Okay. Representative Beck moves Senate Bill 301 as amended by the dash A4 amendments to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Bates?
Aye.
Representative Beck?
Aye.
Representative Hess?
Aye.
Representative Williams?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Savory?
Aye.
And Chair Sederi?
Aye. Senate Bill 301 goes to the floor with a due pass. Anybody want to carry this?
I'll take it, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Williams has it.
I'm going to offer to Representative Butler. Again.
Rule, sense of humor.
Put it there. Okay, that concludes our work on Senate Bill 301, and we will open a public hearing then on House Bill 3057. If I could please have the sign-up sheet, Elizabeth, if you'd bring that with you.
Right. Chairman Shetterly and committee members, what you have with House Bill 3057 is a bill which is allowing land within the boundaries of cities or urban growth areas to be designated as riparian land and partially property tax exempt if those cities and counties have adopted ordinances permitting the designation. The partial property tax exemption will be for the taxes of the city and county districts only, and it's going to apply to tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2002. So under current law, land that is zoned as agricultural, range, or forest land can be designated as riparian land by the State Department of Fish and Wildlife. Riparian land is defined as the beds of streams, the adjacent vegetation, and the land thereunder, which are influenced by water. There is a limit on it. It cannot extend more than 100 feet from the stream bank. Riparian land is property tax exempt under the until the property owner is going to withdraw the land from the riparian land program, or the land use is changed on the land. And when there's a withdrawal or disqualification from the riparian program, then you will have additional taxes equal to the sum of the tax benefit for each year that it was exempt, up to 5 years. So as of April 2001, now the Department of Fish and Wildlife has approved more than 1,030 acres along 77 miles of streams in the state. There's 112 landowners that are currently participating in the program in 22 counties. Benton County has the highest number of acres, 184 acres for 2001. Between 1990 and 2000, though, what we've seen is there's been only 30 new landowners who have received a riparian land designation. On average, there's only about 3 new landowners entering the riparian program. In 2001, the average real market value per account of that agricultural range and forest land in the riparian designation was $87,693. So using some of the averages that we have from the county assessor data, just assuming that there would be approximately 40 new landowners statewide that would be in a city or they'd be within an urban growth boundary that it approves a partial property tax exemption, there could be a reduction in local tax revenue of approximately $17,165 in 2002-03. And $41,300 in the 2003-05 biennium. And granted, there's a lot of, uncertainty with this revenue impact as far as how many people would actually participate in the program versus how many cities and counties would actually approve this particular partial property tax exemption. But it is, again, only for the city and county taxes that comprises only about 41% of all the taxes statewide. And also, you need to have each landowner's amount of the exemption would really vary depending on the type of property that they had and what it was prior.
Okay.
And it was just one last point.
Yeah.
Is that with this bill, what you would see with county assessors is that they would have to separate out their accounts, because for most of these accounts, you would just have a portion of your land that would be exempt, and then you would just have the city and county taxes that would be exempt, and then you'd have to have, the county would have to have another portion of it, which was the taxable portion of that particular property owner. So that's what you see some in the fiscal impact for this bill.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Beck.
So with this, if the city and a county adopt this, and landowner applies for the exemption, can the local government deny the application based on some principle they don't feel the property benefits the riparian corridor, or is this a or is the city required to grant it if someone applies for it and they meet stream frontage criteria?
Representative Beck, basically, once the city or county has approved and adopted that ordinance, they have to allow whoever the Fish and Wildlife department, if they're the ones who are going to make that distinction about whether or not the particular landowner qualifies.
So what we're doing is opening this up to urban landowners to go through the same designation process through ODFW that currently forest and agricultural land and rangeland owners can go through. Otherwise, they've got to meet the same criteria as the existing program.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
That's what I understood. Okay, Susan Schneider and Mary Stevens, if you want to come up and tell us why Portland is interested in this. In Multnomah County.
Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, my name is Susan Schneider with the City of Portland. With me is Mary Stevens with the City of Portland Bureau of Environmental Services, and we're here to talk about House Bill 3057 and why the City of Portland requested this bill be introduced. Mary will tell you about why we want this local option for riparian tax credits. And I'll just talk a little bit more about the bill. It is our intention that these local ordinances would not only allow a jurisdiction to decide whether they can afford to offer a property tax credit, but to limit perhaps to a number of acres or a number of miles within that jurisdiction so that the property tax can be the impact of that can be mitigated to fit the budget of the local jurisdictions who are the county and the city who are looking at this. With that, I'll try to. The other thing is you will have or already have testimony from ODFW, and just to let you know, they did share that testimony with us, and we've discussed it with them, and it is our intent that in developing local ordinances, we would work with them on the workload impacts that they are concerned about to be sure that it is work they can do, since we are asking them to do some more property than they're already working with. With that, I'll turn it over to Mary.
Good afternoon. Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, Ms. Mary Stevens, and the policy coordinator for the City of Portland, Bureau of Environmental Services. And I'm excited to be here today because I think this bill is very worthwhile. We have heard over and over again through our watershed councils and in working with private landowners how important, you know, the incentive programs are. And that's why I'm particularly excited about this bill. I'm excited because it does have standards. It holds the landowners accountable as well as the jurisdictions. There are good standards here. It's a good program. And I think, as it was explained, these folks, you know, are serious about riparian protection for the sake of, you know, riparian protection and protecting the environment. Most of the folks are not out there to make a buck. I think this is a win-win because it does offer the local option, which I think provides an incredible amount of flexibility within the current program for the local jurisdictions to get together and figure out really what works for them in conjunction with ODFW and their county and, you know, their landowners. You know, particularly important to that is the revenue loss and other local water quality issues that can be incorporated into this program. For instance, you may be able to target a certain portion of a watershed that is critically important and offer this incentive. You may want to offer it across the county. I think it's important because it really compensates landowners and rewards them for their conservation efforts. It will provide and promote public-private partnerships and it will maybe help us to incur the cost now for environmental protection rather than what we consider to be the deferred cost for allowing degradation of our riparian areas and then trying to repair them. We found that the cost to allow the degradation and then try to go back and fix it is incredibly more expensive than just trying to preserve things in the first place. I think that House Bill 3057 offers an important opportunity to do something good for landowners as well as the environment. And I hope that you'll support passage of this bill. Take any questions you might have.
Questions for Ms. Stevens or Ms. Schneider?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Beck.
I'm curious, Susan, maybe the counties can ask this better. Who determines how to value the exemption? Is that the assessor that does that?
Chair Shirley, Representative Beck, yes, it is the county that determines that.
Is there a state standard for that? Maybe the counties, when they get up here, they can... Does each county do it differently, or...?
I think the way it works, Representative Beck, is that, you know, this... It's allocated to a maximum of 100 foot wide from the riparian area, and, you know, so you just section out, say, I take so many square footage of this property, and I think that on one tax lot, you could break down and say, you know, this is your total tax for this piece of land, and break that down into a square footage cost.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's pretty much, that portion comes off the tax rolls.
It's a Measure 7 question is why I'm asking it, is to see if there are methodologies out there for determining value of river or stream front property. There's a lot of different ways you could do it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious whether there was a standard out there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, we would defer to the counties on that.
Mm-hmm. If they're not signed up.
Yeah, right.
We'll talk to them later.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, would you like us to talk to them about that and get back to you with written material?
That's a bit of information. And also, I'd like to have ODFMW in here to talk about the criteria, I guess, that they apply in what they require in these plans. I'm not personally familiar with them, and I don't know if anybody else on the committee is.
Mr. Chair, I have a list of their criteria that it's, and I'm sorry I don't have the statutory citation for this right now, but as I understand, their ODFMW's eligibility criteria includes stream and associated riparian land that are, the width is sufficient to support long-term stream bank stability, erosion control, water quality, delivery of large woody debris, fish and wildlife habitat protection, conservation or restoration, and other functions deemed important to the healthy aquatic environment. The vegetation is sufficient to support bank stability, erosion control, and some of those other things, and that the landowner has implemented measures specified in an approved riparian management plan, and that that plan is approved by ODFMW. So it's, I think, kind of qualitative standards that are evaluated based on professional and technical judgment.
And I assume they must have administrative rules that govern the program, too?
Pardon?
They must have administrative rules that govern the program, too?
Mr. Chair, I believe they do.
Okay. Any other questions for Ms. Stevens or Ms. Schneider? Representative Bates.
And this may be more of a question for Elizabeth than for you, but whoever can help me with it. In the summary by our staff, there's a statement that this tax would be lost upon withdrawal, which I assume means the property owner withdrew it, or disqualification of the riparian program. And I sense that's something done by somebody else to the landowner. He or she would be told, you no longer qualify for this, mm-hmm. at which time an additional tax equal to the sum of the tax benefit for each year is due. I'm somewhat concerned that somebody can, in good faith, can do something like this, do the best they can, run into a bureaucratic situation where they lose it, and then have to, after having put some effort into it, have to end up paying back taxes. Is that a possibility under this law?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, I believe the way it works is that the riparian management plan that is developed between the property owner and ODFMW, and then approved by ODFMW in order to get this tax credit, sets forth the responsibilities of the landowner to maintain that property in its riparian state. And I think that offers protection, you know, if the property owner is adhering to that management plan, you know, I think that gives a lot of support to your concern. I don't think it would be something that would, you know, be taken lightly, and I think there's a good defense there for the property owner.
I just hate to see a property owner thinking he or she has done a reasonable job in this, and finding out that they are suddenly owed 5 years of back taxes on the area. And coming from a rural area of the state, there have been times when the owners of the land and the bureaucracy didn't always agree on what was a good effort and what wasn't a good effort, and it can lead to some serious problems. I could certainly see saying to them, at this point, you no longer get a tax exemption. I have a problem with going back 5 years and saying we're disqualifying you from that 5-year exemption now because we don't think you're qualified. I have some problems with that part of it.
I was going to say, Representative Bates, just so you're clear too, I mean, this is pretty standard. With most all exemptions, there's going to be a penalty if you change your use and, you know, to something other than what your land was originally qualifying for.
Okay. I had a question on the fiscal. This does involve ODFMW, and we talked about this in the group this morning. This does involve ODFMW reviewing and passing on these applications. I don't see a number, I guess, that quantifies what that impact would be on the fiscal side. Is it in here somewhere, Elizabeth? I see on the revenue we've got some numbers there, but nothing on the fiscal. Have you had any conversation with them about that?
Mr. Chair, we had a brief conversation just before this hearing, and their difficulty in estimating a fiscal is that because this is a local option, it's hard for them to know how many communities might take advantage of it.
Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, I know I talked with John Fletcher about this in the sense that, you know, what were some of the issues and things that I was looking at in the revenue impact, but I have not given him my revenue impact yet.
Okay. All right. Let's invite up, thank you very much, David Reed from the Johnson Creek Watershed Council. Kind of a propitious day to have you down. I just had watershed people in my office anyway. They're all over, aren't they?
That's right, we're invading.
They're invading, yeah. Flooding is the capital.
Exactly. Chair Steadily, members of the committee, thank you for having me here today to briefly talk to you about House Bill 3057. This bill would make a tremendous impact on the efforts of Johnson Creek Watershed Council to improve the water quality and improve fish and wildlife habitat in the watershed. These individual landowners, of which there are hundreds in the Johnson Creek watershed, all have a really, in many cases, deleterious impact on the creek. And providing some incentives for these people to turn around their impacts and really make a positive change and exhibit some stewardship of the creek would really make a difference in our efforts.
Let me ask, maybe you have an idea, since you're working with the watershed, if Portland and Multnomah County were to enact this as a local option in Multnomah County and the city of Portland, do you have any idea how many of your watershed property owners might be inclined to participate in something like this?
That's a good question. I think there, I can't give you a number estimate,
yeah,
but I think that there would be several people that would be interested. I can think of a few off the top of my head that already have pretty solid riparian management plans that they've taken care of on their own. And I think that would probably be the most immediate impact, is those people who have already engaged in this kind of a restoration program. But for the long term, for the implementation of the Johnston Creek Restoration Plan, which is a really crucial element of recovering species, I think over the long term, I think it would be a much slower process, because it is a fairly serious commitment that these people have to make, and it's a pretty strong agreement that they make with ODFW about what exactly kind of kinds of practices that they're going to be undertaking. So I don't imagine a flood of 40 or 50 in the first year. I think maybe two or three in the first year and a few every year after that. But like I say,
In the
Johnston Creek watershed.
How many watersheds are there in Portland?
In Portland, it depends on how narrowly you define watershed, but the main watersheds are the Johnston Creek watershed, the Columbia Slough watershed, the Tryon Creek watershed, and the Fano Creek watershed. And those all have significant riparian areas. The Willamette River obviously has a watershed, but there's not much of a riparian area that's not either the waterfront park or the central east side industrial. So
houseboats don't count as a plan, huh?
I mean, not.
All right. Any other questions for Mr. Reed? Well, I thank you very much for your testimony. We'll get some more information about this. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing and adjourn. We will start, please, at 1:30 sharp tomorrow. We'll be back up with the Batman and a bunch of other bills, so we'll have a busy day tomorrow. Thank you, everybody. We are done for the day.